BT's chief executive seems to have spent much of the last few weeks preparing his company for a hostile takeover approach. No one has made a formal offer yet, but word on the street is that it's only a matter of time before a rival in Europe or elsewhere decides to capitalise on the share price, which is down by about 40% in the year to date.
The fate awaiting BT and its shareholders, who on top of the share price slump have had to stomach a big dividend cut this year, raises questions about how the company has found itself in this sorry state. To answer that, we have to go back to the 1980s, when Margaret Thatcher had an agenda.
From France to the Philippines, from Jamaica to Japan, from Malaysia to Mexico, from Sri Lanka to Singapore, privatisation is on the move.
BT was not the first company to be privatised under Thatcher's government, but it was considered a turning point in the policy. The first time a company of its size had been taken out of government ownership and put into the hands of the public.
And the public lapped up the opportunity. By the time the deadline on the IPO had expired, the share placing had been oversubscribed by 3.2 times.
But did those investors make the right decision? Have BT and the many other ex-public companies which were listed on the London stock market in the 1980s been good for their shareholders and for the market? Or do the British companies which were privatised now lag their international peers from countries which were perhaps less enthused by the prospect of denationalisation?
Going around Europe in 1981-82, preaching to the Dutch and the Italians and the Germans and the French the virtues of liberalisation and privatisation. And I was treated politely, but they thought I was a lunatic.
With the help of the IC's telecoms correspondent, Lauren Almeida, we are going to attempt to answer that massive question.
I'm Megan Boxall.
And I'm John Heumann. Welcome to the Investment Hour. So, Megan, you've written a market history of privatisations this week. It's a big subject, it's getting to 800 words, but you managed it somehow. How have we got where we are today with companies like BT and others?
Yeah, it is a big topic, which obviously 800 words is not anywhere near enough to cover everything. So we're going to try and cover a little bit more in the next hour. But the article, yes, is on privatisation and how it came about because of Margaret Thatcher. And what she wanted to do to the markets, she decided that the UK's markets weren't in a very good way, and there was a lot of control resting in the hands of the unions around. Well, after several years of Labour government, Margaret Thatcher came to power, and she didn't. When she was running to be Prime Minister, she wasn't talking a huge amount about privatisation, but she was bigging up the markets a lot and saying that we need a fair and free capitalist society.
Popular capitalism is nothing less than a crusade to enfranchise the many in the economic life of the nation.
And what came out of that was a handful of smaller privatisations, so companies including Cable and Wireless, which is another telecoms company, British Aerospace as well, which is now BAE, and those companies which had been government owned and run were listed, or parts of them
yeah,
were listed on the market, kind of as a bit of an experiment. And part of that was to put the control of these companies more into the hands of the general public, and the running of them to be a private enterprise rather than a private enterprise for profits rather than a government scheme.
Well, weren't a lot of these nationalised industries, these state-owned industries, losing a lot of money?
Well, yeah, absolutely. They were, and they were being badly run, and they were just too big, and they were operating in industries where the rest of the world was starting to be a lot more innovative, and that's something that a lot of her cabinet said at the time, that these companies just couldn't catch up with or couldn't keep up with what was happening elsewhere because they were government owned. And as well as that, they did raise a huge amount of money. Selling them raised a huge amount of money for a government which had inherited quite large deficits. So, I mean, the BT IPO, or the initial IPO on its own, raised $3.9 billion.
You mentioned that Thatcher wasn't, you know, perhaps the driving force behind this. So we heard that from a guy called Kenneth Baker, and he came up in something I was writing about last week, which was the massive expansion of interest in information technology in the UK in the 1980s. What was his role in the cabinet at this point?
He was the Minister for Industry and Information Technology, which actually is quite interesting that those two things were combined at the time.
I mean, I think there were a lot of worries at the time about the impact of IT on industry, and it was particularly around the rise of microchips, semiconductors, robotics. I think people were looking at a lot of UK industry at the time, thinking it was somewhat archaic and antiquated, and looking overseas at places like Japan, where they'd really embraced these technologies, and there were massive fears in this country that basically huge swathes of the workforce are going to be made redundant by technology. So it kind of did make sense that these two things came together. There was a big documentary about it in 1978 called Now the Chips Are Down. And the governments were very, very worried about the effects of technology on industry. So perhaps that's why they were combined in that way.
The other thing that Kenneth Baker was worried about specifically was public interest in these companies and how much of a role the general population of Britain played in the actual running and the oversight of these companies. And he said towards the end of the Thatcher era, he said when we came into office there were about 3 million people who owned shares in Britain. By the end of the Thatcher years there were 12 to 15 million shareholders, which is actually about the same as it is today. About 15 million people in the UK are investors. So that was another massive point of all this privatisation, bringing these companies into the forefront and making the public interested in their success.
I remember hearing stories of the 1980s and when these things were taken off. So you did get these huge rushes to buy into things. I remember in the mid 1980s the ad for the British Gas IPO.
Oh, I'm glad you're here. This will interest you. British Gas shares. They come out in November. If you see Sid, tell him.
See, I remember it really well, but everyone bought into these things. Everyone. Millions of people bought into these. And, I was told a story by a stockbroker who was around at the time. They stockbroking counters were set up in places like department stores. It really was, people embraced it hugely at the time. And when I was dealing with an inheritance, what I found in there was three lots of share certificates: BG Group, Centrica, and National Grid. And they were the legacy of people signing up to these IPOs.
And that is actually an interesting point about the IPOs and whether or not shareholders have benefited from them. Because actually, what we'll do in a minute is we're going to go through some of these companies and look at the state that they're in now. A lot of them are not in a particularly good state. But actually, shareholders will have done very well firstly, the duration. They've been listed for a long time now. And secondly, that if you bought into the initial fundraising, you benefited when other parts were listed and when bits were spun out. And there are very few of these companies which were these massive creaking giants which are in the same form as they were when they were listed.
I think people would have done several thousand percent off the back of the British Gas IPO, but as I said, I believe that the value there was created through the spin-outs, as you say, whereas if you look at what's really left today, National Grid is obviously still listed, Centrica is still listed. It's not looking in a very good state today.
No.
And BG fell obviously to a big bid from Shell, so we're now shareholders instead.
Yeah.
Looking at BT, what we actually have here is a company that has probably not created value through its spin-out or spin-outs it could have made. And I think we're going to probably talk about that in a bit, because the fact that Openreach, the infrastructure division, remains part of BT is perhaps one of his biggest sort of sources of cash, but also one of his biggest weaknesses at the same time.
Yeah, we'll go on to talk about BT because it is the topic of the moment, and for the company that was, when it was privatised, was the big star of the show, it's really not looking great at the moment. And I actually commented in my article this week with Margaret Thatcher, who was extremely positive about the BT privatisation at the time. She said BT privatisation did more than anything else to lay the basis for share-owning popular capitalism in Britain. Would she be saying that now, looking at the state that this company is in? It's pretty dire. But before we get on to BT, let's have a look at some of the others, because some of them are interesting. British Aerospace, for example, which was the first. That was actually the process of IPOing British Aerospace was actually started by Callaghan in the Labour government, which came before Margaret Thatcher.
Interesting to hear that it was a Labour idea to do that.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't see it through, but maybe they would have done if they'd stayed in power, but it was, the ball was rolling then. and it was 1981 that it was part of it was spun out onto the market. And today it's BAE, and it's gone through various different guises since then, but BAE is still a very good company, and it's benefited from not being a publicly owned, a publicly run business, because it's expanded into new technology, into, and it continues to be innovative.
Huge expansion overseas. So, you know, BAE's biggest market is the US. Now, you know, in the time when the major supplier of military equipment would have been owned by the government, that just wouldn't have been the case.
Mm-hmm. And the same is true of Rolls-Royce, which, when it was IPO'd in 1987, was making a huge amount of its money in the UK. And now, as well, it's providing defence, it's providing all of its engineering globally, and it had results today. It's struggled today.
They're not pretty, but you can hardly blame...
No, yeah. I mean... And then, I mean, could you say the same for British Airways as well, which actually hasn't been, IAG hasn't been a bad company for a long time. Coronavirus has disrupted the situation, but British Airways, which was also IPO'd in 1987, has benefited from being a global operator rather than a strictly British carrier. So for a lot of these companies, the answer is yes, it has. The IPO has been a success, and those are the companies which have operated in industries where international, where globalisation, where innovation has been really, really important.
I think there was also a story of access to capital and capital markets.
Mm.
So privatisation would have given these companies the opportunity to tap large financial centres for the money they needed to expand and grow their business and invest in the way that they needed to grow, which wouldn't necessarily have been available to them in the same way as government-owned, as state-owned companies. That funding would have generally had to come from the government somehow, and the country didn't simply have it.
Yeah.
Simply didn't have it.
Yeah. And another one, British Petroleum. Yeah, I mean, can you imagine the government funding everything that BP's having to spend at the moment? It's just... It's not something that would have been feasible, but BP now is and continues to be, despite dividend issues this year, a good investment.
I mean, you mentioned dividends. That's one of the interesting things about a lot of these companies. These have been or become, you know, the reliable dividend payers for a lot of people. Mm. You know, and a lot of people who would have held those shares, you know, for 20, 25 years since they were floated. We've got views on dividends and whether the obsession with paying dividends, with receiving dividends, actually has also somewhat stymied the growth of this company, these companies, which is perhaps where we've got to. In the case of some of them, BT being a very good example.
Mm, yeah, and actually, looking down that list, all of those companies which remain on the market are generous dividend payers. Perhaps BAE and Rolls-Royce slightly less so of the group. They are maybe a little bit more responsible with their dividend payments than BT has been. But yeah, the focus on shareholder returns through dividend payments rather than through capital gains, through innovation, growth, capital gains, has been a problem for a lot of British companies. And yeah, and maybe that is part of the legacy of them being, when they were floated, when they were IPO'd, there was this dividend promise, which a lot of them have not gone back on.
Yeah, and there is always this big question of, you know, how much these companies are run in the interests of their customers rather than in the interest of making profits for shareholders. And sometimes those shareholders are private shareholders. So some of the water utilities, for example, Thames Water.
Yeah.
There are always debates around whether this model, you know, has really shortchanged the customer in many instances. Certainly, you know, in the power market, we talked about Centrica, but there were always great concerns that it was overcharging its customers. They couldn't switch very easily, and that market has liberalised a bit, which is a bit more, which is and opens up to a lot of competition, which is why Centrica is probably having a lot of the troubles that it has. But that's not been the case for all of these industries.
No, I do think the Centrica and the British Gas issue is really interesting, because it almost feels like it's a few years in ahead of BT in terms of what the regulators are doing. They've had more of a role. They've been harsher to the energy and the power industry than they have been in the telecoms industry, and that has bred a much more competitive marketplace. British Gas is not the one and only, or one of just two big players. We call them the Big Six because there are six. There are six very, very competitive companies in that market. And now there are a whole host of other ones, which the regulators have welcomed because of the energy price cap. It's made it harder for the companies like British Gas and Centrica to make money. And it's a real problem for these ex-nationalised companies because they kind of, like, on the one hand, they're trying to grow and they're trying to be private companies and be innovative. On the other hand, they've got the regulators constantly making sure that they're not monopolies, and they are. And British Gas was certainly an example of that when it IPO'd, and now it's definitely not a monopoly. And the regulator has helped that. And would you want to own shares in Centrica right now? I don't think so.
We do happen to own some, actually, through the flotation in 1984.
But that's different. So would you buy some now?
That's a very different question altogether. No. No, I probably would not. But, you know, would you buy BT shares? That's a different question altogether.
One
which Phil Oakey's actually looked at this week, but we'll come back to that shortly. But I mean, going back to the question of, you know, the amount of profit that these companies are allowed to make, and why perhaps that's made them unattractive as investments. You know, this is something that just before the last election really kicked off in a big way. You know, there was a real push from the socialist side of the debate, you know, to argue that these companies should be renationalised. You know,
yeah.
It was a really serious threat. You know, many saw it as a serious threat.
Absolutely.
As that election rumbled on.
If you use Twitter, people were genuinely thinking, because of Twitter being an organisation which broadcast that message maybe more than the capitalist message. It did seem for quite a while like Labour might win, and there might be all these industries that were being renationalised, starting with the utility providers, which were actually privatised more recently. Some of them were under Tony Blair's Labour government, the privatisation of them. But they're another one which they've been more tightly regulated than BT has. And does that make them more secure? It doesn't welcome competition, which was one of the reasons why Margaret Thatcher wanted to privatise all these companies. She thought that competition was needed to promote industry growth. But keeping a tight hold, like the water companies have had, I mean, how can you enter the water industry as a new player? You just can't. It's impossible because it is so tightly regulated.
I think water is where most of the concerns lie, because, you know, it's hard to switch.
Yeah.
And there are some quite, you know, aggressive private equity backed ownership in that sector,
yeah,
as well. During that election, it was I think someone put a bill on this renationalising all of the things that had been spun off. $176 billion, according to the Centre for Policy Studies.
Wow.
Not sure where they were ever planning to get that money from, but, you know, even the Conservatives had suggested that the water companies and their use of offshore tax structures was irresponsible.
Well, the water companies is one that I really don't understand why they're not government owned anymore, because they're not being no one's benefiting from them apart from the shareholders. And there isn't any growth. The consumer is really not benefiting from it. I mean, where I live, we have to use Affinity Water. That's it. There is no other option. And so what's the point in it being a privately owned private enterprise?
Having said that, I mean, the regulators are fairly tight on the water groups. You know, there is a regulatory settlement.
Yeah.
They are allowed to make certain amounts of
which,
money.
Again, begs the question, why are they listed? Because they're so tightly regulated, they can't grow. They just continue to get their dividends out every year. That's why holding them for income is the only reason why they need to be on the market.
And they have to be relatively safe. That's
yeah.
Right. slash dividends.
Yeah. But, yeah, it is a... whether or not the utility companies should be on the market is an interesting question. And it's also an interesting question in the argument around BT, because the more and more the world uses technology and telecoms, the more and more BT is a utility company, a pure utility company.
It's quite interesting, because, you know, perhaps the regulators are tougher on industries like energy or to an extent water, which they are, because they're seen as necessities,
yeah,
household necessities, whereas perhaps telecoms and broadband has historically been seen as more of a luxury.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a time when, you know, you didn't have to have a telephone in your home. You went up to the phone box up the road. Don't quite remember that, quite, thank God. But you know, broadband is now seen as a necessity. I think, you know, COVID-19 has proved, you know, for many people stuck in their homes, for economic activity to continue, it's not a luxury.
But even for us, I mean, we're in the office now, and one of our meetings this morning was bordering on not doable because one person had atrocious Wi-Fi. And yeah, I think in this day and age, telecoms is a necessity, not a luxury, which is perhaps leads nicely on to BT, how we're here, why BT is inherent to the problems in the UK's telecoms industry.
So I looked at some numbers in my editorial this week on this subject of broadband quality, numbers that are put together by a company called Cable. It's called the Worldwide Broadband Speed League. And the UK ranks 35th in the world on its broadband infrastructure. So you've got Singapore and Taiwan at the top, as you would expect, these very modern economies. But then above us, you've got countries like Slovakia, Slovenia, and one place above us, Madagascar.
That is just so, so shocking.
And, you know, a lot of it, we've actually got really good broadband coverage in the UK, but it's been done in a way that is essentially cheaper to do what BT have largely done, which is fiber to the cabinet, or not even that. We have very, very poor fiber coverage in this country, so our broadband is slow.
So let's bring Lauren in now, because you're our telecoms expert. How bad is the situation? How have we got here? And what role has BT played in it being like that?
Well, the connection is really bad in the UK. I think it's about like 12% of UK households have access to fibre broadband. And it's just because they've not been investing enough in Openreach. I mean, there is an argument that they've kind of been, the dividend may be good for shareholders, but it's cost a lot, and they should have been funneling that money into capital expenditure.
So Openreach being the utility part of BT, the bit that owns and operates and builds the actual network.
Yeah, and that cut to the dividend until 2022 is gonna save them around £3 billion. And I mean, you know, it's kind of been done whilst loads of companies have been cutting their dividends because of coronavirus, but really I think this is probably a good excuse to kind of push that money towards Openreach, which is where it should be.
So historically, that money, that 3.2 every year, or sometimes slightly more than that, was, when they paid special dividends, was obviously not being invested in the network. Why is BT, why is Openreach so important to the UK telecoms infrastructure?
It basically supports everyone's internet. Like, there isn't, it's the market leader, and without it, I mean, that's the reason why the shoddy connections are so disparate across the country. It's why that the UK is so behind on that list of countries. Without it, without proper investment in it, the economy is eventually not going to be as competitive as those other countries like Taiwan and Singapore, because we've got rubbish connection, and especially because people are working from home now. It really affects the way businesses are operating.
So, BT, I mean, it's hard to say that BT's not to blame in the situation.
It's obviously prioritised dividends over investment in this network.
Yeah.
But we know how expensive this network is going to be. They've put some rough numbers on it themselves. I think they said they expect to spend £12 billion getting this fibre to the premises to 20 million homes by mid to late 2020s. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of speculation about where it can possibly come from within BT as it currently is.
Yeah. Yeah, so then maybe it comes back to, as well, BT's mismanagement and where it spent money. And Phil has actually looked at some of the numbers of that this week. It spent a lot of money on broadcast and its consumer section. £2.4 billion on broadcast rights is they've committed to spend in the next few years, and that's on top of all the spending on the fact that they want to spend a lot on Openreach, and they spent more. So 2017, 2018, 2019 were just ridiculous years for spending on TV rights, especially the sport. The getting football was so expensive. I mean, has that distracted the company from investment in Openreach?
I think they would have felt they had to do it at the time. So if you looked at the way the market was evolving, you know, there was a move from sort of selling individual services like the pipes, as it were, you know, the telephone's connection, the broadband connection, or the mobile phone, or if you were Sky selling small through your satellite dish, and it's all started to coalesce.
Yeah.
You know, they call it sort of bundling. And actually, we did a big bit of research when I was one of my previous jobs with the Bundle Jungle, which I think is still going, which is about how this market evolved. And yeah, I think they thought they had to do it because people wanted to buy a triple play, quad play, and they felt if we don't have the content, we won't be able to sell our lines either.
But this is what I find really weird about the situation, because not all of the telecoms companies did that. And the ones that are still thriving, like Liberty Global, for example, that's still a decent company. And to a certain extent, Vodafone as well. They focused on spending on their own infrastructure and international expansion rather than the bundle thing. And Sky was never a telecoms company, not in the purest form of telecoms. I don't understand why BT ever went into sports and the consumer market in the way that it did.
But Sky did go into telecoms.
But it went the other way.
Well, it did. It went from content into telecoms. It bought a company called EasyNet a number of years ago. It wasn't a big ISP, but it was internet service provider. But it was big enough to help them strategically do what they needed to do and start offering those bundles. So I think BT, when that started to happen, and of course you had competition, you know, there was a lot of regulatory pressure for it to open up its exchanges, to let other people access its core networks. I think it got a bit scared, and that expenditure on football rights and such alike is the consequence of that.
And also the massive blunder they made in selling off their own mobile phones business.
Huge.
And then buying EE for a ridiculous amount of money a few years later. I mean, that was a real management muck up. And yeah, so to a certain extent management has been to blame, but then also they have struggled with the fact that it is a legacy government run business.
BT's attitude after privatisation was the world hasn't changed very much, but the world was changing dramatically, and it took some time for them to adjust, but they still acted like a monopolist.
So yeah, I mean, I think that's an amazing insight there from Kenneth Baker again. You know, he must have been talking, you know, a decade ago or so, maybe a little bit more. But you know, I think BT didn't really change that much, and it still really hasn't changed that much. It still acts like a monopolist, and you know, it's, in some respects, the whole Openreach debacle is a reflection of the fact that it really doesn't want to let go of that monopoly network position in the UK.
So Openreach is a monopoly, and so the Openreach debacle, which was what, 3 years ago, the regulators wanted to do something about Openreach. They didn't really know what, and so what they landed on was they're going to be split out into a separate company, but that company is 100% owned by BT, which is such a cop-out, and it was just ridiculous.
It was a really bad cop-out.
It was so bad.
I was pretty cross when I heard that.
It was so bad, and which meant that Openreach can continue to to milk the cash from this monopoly, and that cash has gone into the dividends, and it's gone into the pension deficit, and it's gone into the consumer business. It has not stayed within Openreach, however much the regulators would like to think that it would have done. It hasn't. And now I think BT is being called up on that, finally. Putting a new chief executive in Openreach and then a new chief executive into BT, because Gavin Paterson was pretty appalling. And Philip Jansen, the current chief executive, does seem to be making slightly better decisions. The company is investing a lot in BT. I mean, I think if you're an engineer, you don't call BT up and be like, where do you need me to go? Everywhere is laying fibre cables, because they know now that they really, really need to catch up with the rest of the world, but also competition within the UK. That is what has sparked, and that is what, going back to privatisation, what Kenneth Baker and Margaret Thatcher were talking about a lot at the time. They wanted to spark competition, in the telecoms industry.
Well, there was some competition at times. A company called Mercury.
Yeah, so that was part of Cable and Wireless.
Right, so an old state-owned enterprise.
And Cable, the
meets against an old state-owned enterprise.
Yeah, absolutely. And Cable and Wireless has absolutely, like, I mean, it flopped. And the remains of Cable and Wireless were bought by Vodafone a couple of years ago.
But the point Kenneth Baker was making there was that this competition had arrived, had emerged. It obviously needed access to the national infrastructure, mm-hmm. and BT got in the way.
Yeah. Yeah, and the regulators weren't strong enough to do anything about it, and that was hugely problematic. And it's taken really innovative companies with a lot of money behind them. So CityFibre was a listed company until a few years ago, and it has been bought by private equity. Obviously, very deep pockets, huge investment, and all of a sudden, BT's got a bit of competition, and Vodafone and CityFibre are working together to actually invest in, and so they're doing much more regional networks, they're doing hubs outside of the main economic centres, and it's made BT, well, and Openreach sit up and think, and that's a good thing, but maybe not necessarily for the shareholder.
Well, no, I mean, you've also got other competition that's been around perhaps a little bit longer, Virgin, obviously, mm-hmm. I think they can reach about 15 million homes. Mm. So you know, fibre is coming.
Yeah.
Yeah, BT, they have to do something. I think this is why Phil talks about, look, you've got this amazing asset in Openreach within BT, but, you know, extracting the value from it's going to prove very hard. It's why the sum of the parts of BT is actually greater than the whole.
Yeah, well, BT's market cap at the moment is 10.4 billion. And in March 2020, Openreach regulatory financial statement said it was worth 14.4.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of a disparity there. I don't know where they get 14.4 from. And if there is going to be more competition, and 14.4 maybe sounds a little bit steep.
It maybe does. It maybe does. But, you know, there are other bits of BT as well. Mm. So, you know, if you consider that, we were talking about it the other day, it has a business infrastructure, mm-hmm. it has global services, mm-hmm. it has a consumer marketing division, it has, you know, so is all that worth minus four billion? Or minus whatever billion? It's, yeah. You know, it's undervalued. As a company, its shares are undervalued.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
But extracting that value, as Phil argues, is going to prove pretty tricky, partly because you've got this intense competition that's emerging in its main market.
Yeah. So, Lauren, as someone who looks at BT quite regularly, is there hope if you're a shareholder? Is there hope of recovery?
Well, I think because the share price is so low at the moment, I think it's attracted some attention, or maybe it's definitely given rise to chatter on the street about a potential takeover. So Sky News reported last weekend that BT had asked Goldman Sachs to prepare a bid defence strategy, or update that strategy. And so they didn't identify any specific candidates for a takeover, but it's a lot to take on. I mean, it's the huge pension deficit, and it's also Openreach, and there's also the security question about Huawei and taking that out of British networks. So the share price is like extremely low. Maybe there is hope for a recovery now that sports is back, and that might help bump up the share price a little bit and help with the consumer division. And kind of the country's coming out of lockdown very slowly, so that might help. But I think in the long term, as Phil kind of argues this week in the magazine, it's really hard to kind of unlock all of the value that's kind of hidden in BT at the moment.
I mean, the shares bounced this week when this news that, mm. that Goldman yeah. Sachs was being lined up.
But the shares also went up when the FT reported that someone was interested in buying stake in Openreach, and then it went back down again. So
people will love shareholders would love a takeover battle. But how about spinning bits out? Would that be the best option? If going back to the fact that these companies, some of them, the spin-outs is actually what unlocked value for the shareholders. Is that the right answer for BT?
Well, I think that on the one hand, for Openreach spinning it out, I think the argument is that maybe that kind of would give a cash injection, might help the pension deficit a little bit. But from my understanding as well is that Openreach is really important as a cash asset for the pension fund. So how does BT kind of plug that shortfall if it then spins out Openreach?
I wonder how many times that question has been circulated around the boardroom at BT.
What do you do? If this company is essentially, you know, a pension fund with some telecoms assets on the front of it, then why is that a company you want to invest in?
Mm.
You know, if the value in that organisation is within open reach, but they can't extract that value because of this pension scheme. You know, why is that a company we would want to invest in?
Exactly. And is the does the company need some help in sorting out its pension deficit? Because a lot of it wasn't its fault. It did cancel, well, it did shift its pension to a defined contribution from a defined benefit scheme. I mean, maybe a little bit later than it should have done, but it's done that now. It's managing its pension better now, but it's this legacy deficit is something. How are they ever going to plug that gap?
Someone has to solve it. Someone has to solve it. And, you know, will they solve it within the current structure? Probably not, because they haven't solved it for the best part of 30, 40 years. You know, does the spin-out make more sense? I think it does. I wish that they'd have done that 3 years ago, when they instead came up with this convoluted structure of ownership of Openreach. Because then you have an asset, you know, you have a business that can invest because it knows it can then sell that those services to whoever it likes, and actually genuinely create a competitive market.
Mm-hmm.
Genuinely attract the investment that it needs to build the infrastructure that the country needs.
Members of the BC Pension Scheme have to be protected, but then to what extent are those members of the BC Pension Scheme being protected to the detriment of the UK's telecoms infrastructure? And at the moment, it feels like quite a lot. So surely there needs to be a bit of help in managing that pension deficit, and so that BT can spin out what it needs to spin out, make good business decisions, which will allow for it to be a genuine player in the UK's growth in telecoms.
I mean, you have to ask yourself how other countries have managed to deliver really good telecom services, broadband services. You know, one of the potential bidders that people are talking about here is Deutsche Telekom.
Yeah.
You know, go to France, go to Germany, go to Spain. You know,
so much better.
Their networks are so much better.
Yeah.
How have they done it? Presumably, they were similar types of companies to BT.
Yeah. Well, Deutsche Telekom is a very similar company, but it has invested better. It's kept a tighter grip on its spending, partly because it can, because it hasn't. The dividend mentality in Germany isn't quite as strong as it is here, partly because it doesn't have a huge pension deficit to the extent that BT does, and partly because it's been managed better. And I think Gavin Paterson has a lot to answer for there, because he was in charge of BT for a long time and very, very bad decisions were made. And when Philip Jansen came on board, I mean, he is a bit of a specialist in spin-outs, and he came from Worldpay, which had so he was the chief executive when it was acquired by Vantiv in 2018. So Philip Jansen is used to being chief executive of a company which is going through some sort of spin-out, takeover, reverse takeover. He's known for that, and he's good at it. Actually, when he was appointed chief executive, I was absolutely convinced that Deutsche Telekom was going to make a bid for BT that day. I was so convinced. I was late to a football match because I wanted to write the story so badly. So I was 2 years early, but I was so sure that Deutsche Telekom were going to make a bid. And it looks like they will in the next few weeks. There's going to be some sort of... I mean, surely Deutsche Telekom are going to be involved in the discussion. And then there may be other companies which are involved in, I want part of it, I want this part, I want that part. Maybe that's where BT will end up.
In bits,
yeah.
What a shame.
So, to go back to that initial question, has privatisation worked?
Yes and no. Lovely cop-out answer. No, but it has. Because, you know, you actually look at things like the railways, you know, they were in a mess. And I saw you put a face there, because we all have to endure the railway still, but they are better run, more timely. There are huge numbers of passengers on them these days. It's many, many, many more passengers than there were when it was privatised. Yeah, it's not always perfect, but you know, and actually the sort of infrastructure operating company model isn't great, but it's a lot better than it was.
And how about BT? Was privatising BT the right thing to do in the 80s?
Well, I think it probably was, because otherwise, you know, you would have had a government-owned telco that also didn't invest. You know, there has been some progress here. You know, Openreach is something that can be accessed by competition. Yeah, we do have. BT have been, you know, pretty innovative. I mean, we haven't got the fastest wallpaper in the world, but it's not terrible either. Mm. You know, fibre to the cabinet, as Phil writes, it's a pretty clever bit of technology that they've delivered there. So, you know, it's done good things. Lots of people still use it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't look convinced.
I don't know. It's difficult. It's very difficult. I don't think there was enough support given for. I think BT has struggled with fighting a regulatory battle, but without having any support. And how could it ever both grow and support the legacy parts of the business with the regulation around it? And not enough has been done to put BT on the right track. And it is still a monopoly. Openreach is a monopoly, and it's been 30 years, and potentially there should have been more competition in the UK's telecoms network in that time, and the regulators haven't done enough to promote competition.
Yeah, I mean, I think looking at more recent privatisations, you know, Royal Mail is another interesting example, which we haven't discussed yet. I mean, has that worked for shareholders? No.
No way, not yet.
So, you know, I think that floated at it's about 4.5 quid, 455p. The shares are now 180p.
Ugh.
And, you know, you kind of struggle to see how they can grow in the face of competition in the, you know, the logistics, the parcels market, with their universal service obligation, which I guess is another bit of regulation that holds them back as a private company. So, it hasn't worked there.
No.
But if you'd been a British Gas shareholder on day one, you'd have made... There are points at which you'd have made something like 18,000%. Although if you'd hung on to your Centrica shares for a little bit longer, you would probably be ruining it. It's yes and no.
So what next? Will we see parts of the BBC coming onto the market? Parts of the NHS? There are still lots of industries in the UK which are almost 100% government owned and operated. And I mean, BT isn't doing a very good job at showing that privatisation can be good, but if it does, I mean, Royal Mail was 2013, and there is still appetite for. There was clearly still appetite for the shares at the time. Maybe there isn't now, but yeah, maybe the BBC will be the next thing to see on the market.
Absolutely.
See on the market.
Well, the Royal Mail IPO was massively oversubscribed.
Mm.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, there's often talk of privatising. You know, it's a route now for for getting problem children off of the government's books a lot of the time. The BBC is definitely a problem child.
Yeah.
Quite what you'd be buying, I don't know. Because the only way it makes its money is through, really, a licence fee.
Yeah.
So what have you got? You've got bits of, you know, it's sort of global business and world service and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and it's got a lot of its own studios, and it sells its own content.
Also buys in a lot of content as well. Mm. So yeah, I mean, the NHS, you know, that is the sacred cow. Never privatise the NHS, even though, as we well know, lots of bits of it are already quite well served by private providers.
Yeah. A topic we'll be discussing shortly.
Yes, yeah, so it's a big subject anyway. And you could argue till the end of time and probably never come to a conclusion. But unfortunately, this podcast has to come to a conclusion. Yeah, thanks Megan, and thanks Lauren for a good discussion. But before we go, let me just talk you through what else we've got in this week's magazine. There's lots on BT. As I said, Megan has looked at the history of privatisations and BT's role within that, and we've looked at the latest news that it's mounting a big defence, and Phil has looked at some of the numbers behind it, as we've alluded to, particularly the hidden value in Openreach and how difficult it might be to extract that. We've got lots of results in the companies section this week. I think it's going to stay busy for a while yet, along with all the usual tips. A lot of stuff in the money and funds section. Dave Baxter this week has looked at niche ETFs. These are the ETFs that give you exposure to very specific trends like healthcare or technology or aging populations or whatever else it might be, automation and robotics. And he's trying to understand what role they can play in your portfolio and and how you manage the extra risks that actually come with them. Lots of comment this week, some very interesting stuff from Chris Dillo and Mr. Bearball. Lots in the news. Nilusha Kumaratne has looked at the sharing economy, which could be another casualty of COVID-19. Nobody wants to share anyone else's stuff anymore. The cover feature this week, which is also written by Lelouchy, which is about hydrogen, looking at what's been touted as the fuel of the future and asking whether the hydrogen economy, the idea of the hydrogen economy, could make for a hot investment, or is it all just hot air? Shares in hydrogen companies have been flying this year, but it could be a bit of a bubble. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, Lauren. Thank you, Megan. We'll be back again next week. In the meantime, get off to the newsagent, pick up the magazine, or get online and subscribe. Thank you.